Let's go back and remind you. Let me remind you, because if your memory is as bad as mine, we have visited three classes of drugs that affect protein synthesis: tetracyclines, macrolides, bacteriostatic agents, aminoglycosides, bactericidal agents, but with a lot of serious side effects. Now I want to talk about some individual drugs, and this will sort of round out the discussion of protein synthesis inhibitors. And the drug we're going to begin with is a drug that has received over the years a lot of notoriety, and you'll see why in a second. And this is the drug chloramphenicol. And this is the structure of chloramphenicol. The compound, again, like all of these, is a product of a bug. It's made by a microorganism, even though the drug today is totally synthetic. But originally, it was identified and isolated from a microorganism, and here's the structure. You can take chloramphenicol and sort of chop it into three pieces. One piece to the left is an aromatic ring with a nitro group, and we're going to see this may be suspicious in terms of a side effect. And then there's a three-carbon interior here that has a primary alcohol. This is going to be the primary site of acetylation by the R-factor-mediated transferase that leads to resistance. And then there's simply an amide side chain here. So we're going to come back to this, and we'll also come back to this nitro group. Just to bias you, let me say nitro groups tend to be infrequent in biological compounds, and when they are present, they tend on many occasions to lead to serious problems. So, how does chloramphenicol work? Chloramphenicol works to inhibit protein synthesis, now by a mechanism that we've seen before. It binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit. So it binds here to this subunit, and it blocks peptidyl transferase. Peptidyl transferase is one of the proteins that make up the 50S ribosomal subunit. So peptide bond formation cannot occur. The drug is a bit schizophrenic. It is bacteriostatic against many organisms, and I think by definition we would consider it a bacteriostatic agent. However, there are a few organisms against which it's bactericidal. And these organisms are Haemophilus influenza, Neisseria meningitidis, and Strep pneumoniae. So there are three pathogens: Haemophilus, Neisseria meningitidis, and Strep pneumoniae, where chloramphenicol appears to produce acidal effect. Now, over time, bacteria have become resistant to this compound, and they are resistant. The primary mechanism is R-factor encoded transferase enzyme that is an acetyl transferase that transfers an acetyl to this primary alcohol, producing the acetylated product, and the acetylated chloramphenicol has less affinity for the 50S ribosomal binding site. Now, in terms of its pharmacology and then in terms of its clinical spectrum. If you just allow me to flip to the next page, the pharmacology is pretty much described here off to the right. Chloramphenicol is really the atypical antibiotic. We have talked about drugs that are polar, water-soluble, by and large, not great substrates for extensive metabolism by the liver. Chloramphenicol, on the other hand, we're going to see is a lipid-soluble drug. This is more like the drugs you've been exposed to previously. And so chloramphenicol is given either orally or it can be given parenterally. It is very well absorbed when it is given orally. And in fact, peak levels occur in the central nervous system. One has concentrations in cerebrospinal fluid that are about 50% that of the peak plasma concentration. So it gets into the CSF in the absence of inflammation, and we're going to see in a bit, in the presence of inflammation, its entry is facilitated. Now, an important part of its pharmacology is the fact that the majority of the drug, in order to be eliminated, is glucuronidated. So glucuronal transferase puts a glucuronic acid onto one of the hydroxyls of the chloramphenicol, and it is the glucuronide then, and some very minor products, that are eliminated by the kidneys. And they're eliminated, the metabolite, the glucuronide, is eliminated both by glomerular filtration, but since it is now a glucuronic acid, it is a substrate for active tubular secretion by the acid pump in the proximal tubule, and so the glucuronide is secreted by the proximal tubule acid secretory mechanism into the urine. The clinical spectrum of chloramphenicol has been limited, again, by serious side effects and the entry of better drugs. But basically, this drug is used in the treatment of Bacteroides fragilis. It has some activity against Salmonella, but clearly has activity against pathogens, both gram-positive and gram-negative. This is, for all practical purposes, a broad-spectrum antibiotic. Its lipid solubility is its attractive feature. It can be given and used to treat central nervous system infections, bacterial meningitis. Now, remember what I said. I said against certain pathogens it kills. Haemophilus, Pseudomonas, Neisseria meningitidis, and these are frequent causes of bacterial meningitis. Yeah?
Just to clarify,
sure.
Is it strep pneumo, it kills?
Uh-huh.
Does it do it against Pseudomonas as well?
No. Has no activity. Certainly not clinically useful activity against Pseudomonas. Its use, it may even indicate it here, yeah, its use against these organisms is as a second-line drug when the organism has become resistant to first-line drugs that have less risk associated with the administration of the drug. So what are the risks? What are the side effects associated with this drug? And There have been two or three that have been prominent and really brought this drug to the fore. There have been congressional investigations looking at the safety of this drug, how this drug has been promoted, etc. Let me describe two of them to you. One of the side effects in the early days, since this drug was effective against both gram-positive and gram-negative organisms, it was used in hospital nurseries to control infectious diseases, and that were fairly common and for which there were really few effective agents. And it was observed when the drug was given to a newborn to treat an infection that some newborns, not all, but some of these children would over time stop nursing, they would stop eating, their abdomen would be distended, they would have difficulty breathing, they would have irregular respiration, they would become cyanotic, ashen, gray. Their vascular system would collapse and they would die. In this collection of symptoms became known as the gray baby syndrome. And in time, the basis for the gray baby syndrome was determined. And the basis was the result that in the newborn, the liver microsomal enzyme system, and particularly the ability to conjugate the drug to the inactive glucuronide, was diminished, as was the excretory functions in the child. And if you just look here, what you see is a schematic of blood concentration. Curve A here is in children 1 year of age to about 11, but let's just say 1 year olds, versus here children that are 1 to 2 days of age. And you can see that in these children, because of diminished liver conjugation capacity and diminished renal excretion ability, the drug accumulates and one sees the toxic effects of the drug. That was sort of strike one. And it's known as the gray baby syndrome. Obviously, today, if this drug were to be used, there are better monitoring procedures, etc. But even taking into account the fact that this drug was, the dose was modified based on body weight, it was still would cause these effects. More troublesome were the effects that the drug was able to cause on the hematopoietic system, leading to blood dyscrasias. And this drug, chloramphenicol, has been shown to be responsible for two types of blood dyscrasias or blood abnormalities. And again, I don't want you to memorize. This is for edification. But let me just distinguish these two. One is a toxic effect. The other is an aplastic effect. One is manageable. The other is devastating. So let me just talk you through first the toxic effects. What are the features? What do you see in a patient? And this is dose-dependent, as we will see. Well, if you look at bone marrow under the microscope, it's normal. If you look in the peripheral blood, there may be some anemia. The patient may have some anemia with or without loss of platelets and loss of white blood cells. It is dose-related, so the higher the dose, the greater the frequency of this side effect. It occurs, like most side effects, during therapy. The most common symptom that you see is anemia. And the prognosis is quite good. Stop the drug and the patient will recover over about the next couple weeks. The mechanism for this toxic effect is also understood. And what I didn't tell you when we talked about the structure of the bacterial ribosome being a 70S ribosome versus the mammalian ribosome being an 80S, is that in humans, mitochondria synthesize their own ribosomes, and the ribosome in the mitochondria in your bod closely resembles a 70S ribosome. So the side effect here is believed to be the result of the lipid-soluble drug, in contrast to almost everything else we've seen, the lipid-soluble chloramphenicol getting into the mitochondria and inhibiting mitochondrial protein synthesis that leads to inhibition of red cell maturation, which results in anemia. The other side effect, or blood dyscrasia, is the real troublesome one. And that is the use of chloramphenicol led to what is referred to as an aplastic response, an idiosyncratic, some genetically determined biochemical lesion that leads to these symptoms. And what are the features of this aplastic response? Well, if you look at bone marrow under the microscope, you would see that it is hypoplastic or aplastic. If you looked at peripheral blood, you would see everything is down: red cells, white cells, platelets. There is no relationship to the dose, but it's known that people previously exposed to chloramphenicol are at increased risk for the aplastic response. Don't ask me why, but it smells a bit hypersensitive component. Often occurs weeks to months after treatment has been completed. So the patient has been treated, the infection has been cured, the patient goes back to work, and then weeks, maybe months later, develops the symptoms, the most common of which is purpura, which is hemorrhaging into the skin and internal hemorrhaging, and it is fatal in many cases. The incidence here is somewhere in the range of 1 in 25,000 to 1 in 40,000 people treated. So it's not real common, but the consequences are very real. So that divot has particularly the risk of aplasia or aplastic anemia has significantly diminished the use of chloramphenicol. So what's going on? What's responsible? It's even better than that. There is some evidence that would suggest the villain is the aromatic nitro group. And this aromatic nitro group, you will learn when we get farther down into cancer. I'm going to just draw it like this. This aromatic nitro group can undergo various steps of reduction, all the way down to an amine. In these various species, and I'm going to just call them X and Y and Z, are all potentially toxic species. And it is hypothesized that this, in patients that develop this aplastic response, somehow they have a genetically based lesion or change or modification that results in increased production of these that damage stem cells or hematopoietic cells in the bone marrow. It could be, if you want to flip it, that these individuals have biochemical changes genetically based that make their stem cells more sensitive to these species. The point is, It is the nitro group that clearly has been identified as responsible, and here's how we know it. There is a drug I'm not going to draw the whole thing out, called thi, T-H-I, amphenicol. It's available in Europe. It has less activity than chloramphenicol, and it lacks this group. In patients treated with thiamphenicol, one sees the toxic response. One sees the dose-dependent toxic response just as one sees with chloramphenicol, but one does not observe the aplastic response. Now you're probably saying to yourself, why then is this drug not used here in America in replacing chloramphenicol? And the answer is, I think. Chloramphenicol has received such notoriety that there's not a snowball's chance that the Food and Drug Administration would bring in a drug that even smells like, let alone looks like, chloramphenicol. And the fact of the matter is, one need not, because now you have options called second and third generation cephalosporins and fluoroquinolones, and this risk is not justified. Now, having said that, let me tell you that chloramphenicol is still a useful drug, and it's still being used. It's being used in topical form to treat eye infections. It is still life-saving when individuals have bacterial infections in their central nervous system that are resistant to safer drugs. It can save the life of the patient. So it is still used, but very carefully monitored. Yeah?
Those few patients that have this aplastic response, why couldn't you give them a bone marrow transplant?
You probably could, but I believe that by the time the aplastic response is detected, the patient is too far gone. Okay? And just think of it. It happens in one in 30-some thousand, maybe. Okay? Okay? There's one other side effect, and then we're going to move on to three more drugs, and we'll call it a day. And that is, chloramphenicol is capable of inhibiting liver microsomal enzymes, specifically cytochrome 3A4, that cytochrome isozyme responsible for oxidations. That leads to a variety of drug interactions where it inhibits the metabolism of other drugs that are also substrates for 3A4. Next, I want to talk about a compound, clindamycin, and this should be fairly simple for us to digest. Clindamycin is a drug that is used in the treatment of gram-positive infections and aerobic organisms, particularly Bacteroides fragilis. And I might say infections outside of the central nervous system. So it becomes a drug that can be used to treat streptococci that are resistant to penicillins. It becomes an alternative. But it particularly is effective against Bacteroides fragilis. Rather than beat this to death, let me just tell you, its mechanism of action is identical to that of erythromycin. That is, it binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit. Binding involves this 23S ribosomal RNA species. The binding is reversible. It is a static drug. The binding leads, like erythromycin, to blocking the translocation step of protein synthesis. Bacteria develop resistance to clindamycin, and the resistance mechanism is identical to erythromycin. That is, plasmid-mediated RNA methylase, methylating the adenine residue in that 23S RNA, making binding less effective. Now, in terms of its pharmacology, it is very well absorbed. It is given orally, can also be given parenterally, but it is an orally active drug. Well absorbed, probably 90% of the drug is absorbed from the intestines. It undergoes extensive metabolism to inactive products. The vast majority of these breakdown or metabolites are eliminated in the bile. Now, what are the side effects? They really come in two pieces. One is the drug causes skin rashes. And secondly, this is the drug that is one of the most common causes for the development of Clostridium difficile pseudomembranous colitis. Although the drug is absorbed well, there is sufficient drug in the GI tract to alter the microflora to lead to a superinfection by Clostridium difficile, which generates the exotoxin that's responsible for the colitis. The nausea, diarrhea, and this is now the full-blown result associated with this drug, has to some degree tempered its use in patients. Nevertheless, there still is a niche for it, and I've talked about Bacteroides fragilis, but if you just hop back to acne, I said there are other drugs that can be used to treat acne, and these drugs inhibit the bug's ability to produce free fatty acid, and some even can be used topically. Clindamycin is one such drug. Now, there are two other compounds that I want to talk about. Let me preface it by saying these are recent entries into the options available to a physician for treating methicillin-resistant or multiple drug-resistant organisms. And here's their real niche, but not exclusive. Their real niche is to treat vancomycin-resistant organisms. We said vancomycin was life-saving because it was a drug that was effective against methicillin-resistant staph. It was multiple drug-resistant strep. It was effective against enterococci. Well, what do you do when the bug sees the drug a lot, selects out resistant organisms, and now clinicians are dealing with vancomycin-resistant enterococci, vancomycin-resistant strep and staph. And here are two approaches, two drugs that have been introduced to specifically but not exclusively target those organisms. One of the groups or one of the preparations involves two drugs, and they are part of a class of drugs called streptogrammins. And these drugs I did not name, okay, that make up one such preparation are called quinupristine and delfopristine. And they compose the preparation that is used to treat these multi-drug resistant organisms. And the composition of the drug combination is, which has been shown to be the most synergistic, consists of 30 parts of this to 70 parts of this, and you need not memorize it. The two drugs in this preparation both inhibit bacterial protein synthesis, but they do it by different mechanisms and in different ways, and they lead to synergy. So, I think the easiest way to dissect these two is to go by initials. So quinupristine will be Q, dalfopristine will be D, and I'll describe for you how they work and their mechanism of action. They bind to different sites on the 50S ribosomal subunit. And in fact, they bind, if this is the subunit, they bind in a way to get to produce a ternary complex. One binds here and the other binds here. So you have two drugs binding at different sites on the 50S ribosomal subunit. Q, or quinupristine, blocks the addition of an amino acid at the A site. So the result of binding here of Q blocks this step. D, or delfopristine, binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit at an adjacent site or a different site, and it inhibits peptidyl transferase. So two compounds, lookalikes, two peas in a pod, different binding sites, different mechanism of action that leads to a synergistic response. The drugs, or this preparation, is given parenterally. In fact, it's given intravenously. It extensively distributes to fluids in tissues outside of the CNS. Fluids and tissues. It undergoes some metabolism, with the majority of the drug and metabolites eliminated in the bile. Well, how is it used clinically? It is used to treat vancomycin resistant Enterococcus faecium. And in fact, that is its recommended use. That's not its only use. It's also used to treat vancomycin resistant Staph aureus, vancomycin resistant strep pneumoniae. Yeah. Pardon? Yeah. It's staph aureus and strep, but Enterococcus faecium. There are two major species of strains of enterococci, faecium and faecalis. This is only useful against faecium. The activity of the drug appears to be bactericidal, or the combination. But in the treatment of Enterococcus faecium, it is bacteriostatic. The side effects that one sees, I guess I would say, are manageable. Many are related to the site of infusion. There's pain, there's inflammation, there's edema. There may even be thrombophlebitis. And this occurs in about 75% of people treated, but clearly is not a deterrent to treatment. Also importantly, it has drug interactions, or more specifically, it is a potent inhibitor of cytochrome 3A4. So when streptogrammins are used in the presence of drugs, other drugs that are substrates for cytochrome 3A4, the streptogrammins inhibit the metabolism, elevate the blood level, and can cause side effects from this drug interaction. One other drug to talk about. Streptogrammins represent drugs for the treatment of vancomycin-resistant organisms that are given intravenously. There's a recent drug that has come onto the market called linezolid. It's an organic molecule, not made by a bug, but made by a chemist. And this drug is an orally active agent, and we'll see how it works and then its spectrum and side effects in just a second. So let's first look to see how it works. And let me preface it by saying, and then I'll show you the picture. It binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit, and its binding is through the 23S RNA fragment. And here's how it works. It binds to the 50S ribosomal subunit, OLA, and it prevents, so I'm going to just hypothesize, it binds right here. And it prevents the attachment of the 50S ribosomal subunit to the 30S subunit to which the message in the N-terminal amino acid has been attached. So it blocks this step, thus the complete initiation process or product is not formed, the process cannot be completed, protein synthesis cannot occur. The drug inhibits protein synthesis in a way that leads to a bacteriostatic response. The drug can be given orally, or the drug can be given or administered intravenously. The drug, when given orally, is well absorbed. When given intravenously, distributes, again, extensively but peripherally to tissues and fluids. Parent drug and metabolites are excreted both by the kidneys and by or in the bile. What's the spectrum of activity of this drug? And here's the spectrum, and again, you can see its potential value. It's effective against both Fecalis and Faecium enterococci that are resistant to the first choice drug, which would be vancomycin. So this is the reserve. This is the trump. It is effective against staph, particularly methicillin resistant. It is resistant or effective against Streptococcus pneumoniae that is penicillin resistant. But it provides an alternative now to the streptogramins for the treatment of vancomycin-resistant organisms. The side effects that one sees with this drug are manageable, and it is fairly well tolerated. There's some nausea, some diarrhea, some headache, some skin rash, nothing particularly that would prevent the use of the drug. And it produces a reversible thrombocytopenia in about 2 to 3% of patients treated. So the side effect profile with this drug is such that the use of the drug is not prevented or is not associated with serious side effects in its use to treat these multiple drug resistant. Well, we're farther along than I thought. Let me tell you where we're headed, even to Armageddon here. Next week, we're going to deal with drugs that work in the cytoplasm to inhibit synthesis and use of folic acid. This is going to be a flashback to biochemistry a little bit. I apologize, okay? But you know it all, you just don't remember it. And those are the sulfonamides. Then we will move to fluoroquinolones, which are the active area of antibiotic development now, certainly the most active. And then we'll pick off a stray drug. That will be Monday. On Wednesday, we're going to deal with tuberculosis and look at the drugs that treat mycobacterial infections, and specifically we're going to focus on tuberculosis. And then we should have some time on that a week from today to go through some review questions, because on the following Monday there will be the exam, which I think is what the third one that you've had in here.
Are you
going to
give us practice review questions?
I'm going to give you a few, okay? I don't know what Watkins did, but I can't meet his standard, I'm sure. But I will give you some, and better yet, I'm going to try to save some time in class to talk through. So here's what you need to do. You need to come somewhat prepared. If you think this is going to be Gerber's feeding you the answer, it ain't, okay? So I will happily go through some questions. I think I have a half a dozen or so. And we can talk through. I will take questions. I will be available, et cetera, et cetera. And the exam is like every other exam that you've had. Too many multiple choice questions and a few discussion questions.
And then you have the essay.
Yes. The essay comes in pieces. And I can't, in all honesty, I can't remember the pieces. But, 5 points here, 6 points there. And it totals up to 20 points.